Chapter 56. The Rape of Czarland. The French politicians, heirs to the bloody revolution of 1789, had I never forgotten or got over the fact that the German Rhineland had been occupied by revolutionary troops for a few years. In 1814 the German Rhineland was liberated and returned to Germany. The French revolutionaries and Napoleon had occupied the Rhineland for 15 years out of 2,000 years. Yet this brief period of history was sufficient for all French socialists from 1789 to 1919 to consider that part of Germany as irrevocably theirs. Generations of political campaigners whipped voters into a frenzy for the return of the lost territories. In the winter of 1919 the heirs to Robespierre and Danton demanded the return of the German province of Czarland to the Republic of France, the sacred heritage the revolutionary cutthroats had invaded. While they were mass murdering their countrymen in France, the revolutionary apostles of terror had invaded the southern part of Czarland in 1792, 1793, and 1794 with equal violence. The invasion had spread to Belgium and Holland until the entire Rhineland had been conquered. The revolutionaries who had imposed their despotism on France with unparalleled terror had also imposed their domination of other lands with force and violence. The revolutionary propaganda was as cunning as it was hypocritical. They had local agents, or their own bureaucrats, pass motions of support for the invaders everywhere. These motions gave the appearance of a popular vote in favor of revolutionary occupation. Belgian archives showed how so-called plebiscites in favor of annexation with the revolutionary regime were manufactured, only 1 or 2% voted against it. The other 98% who refused to go along with such a travesty were then considered to be in favor of the occupation. Based on the premise, those who say nothing give consent, the revolutionaries acquired vast chunks of European territory, from Hamburg to the Adriatic, with the apparent enthusiastic support of the local populations. Tardieu was merely carrying on the war of liberation his revolutionary predecessors had started in 1789. The communistic purpose of these latter-day guillotine revolutionaries was cloaked in lachrymose rhetoric and pseudo-patriotism in order to generate emotions among ordinary French people for the return of all long-lost Frenchmen. When Robespierre's favorite officer, Napoleon Bonaparte, became Emperor of France, the benefit of the newly acquired lands was felt in his armies. The majority of his generals came from the north and displayed the Germanic qualities that enabled him to perform his epic conquests and battles. Historically, the Germanic northerners had shown outstanding military qualities. The Flemish conquered Ceuta and Tangiers for the King of Spain. Brabant knights saved Central Europe from the Turks in the early 1600s. The Brothers of the Sword and the Teutonic Knights protected Europe from the Mongol invasions. It was Germanic blood that provided for the defense of Europe as well as its leading military chiefs. 1,200 out of Napoleon's 2,000 generals were of Germanic blood. It is doubtful that without them he could have conquered Europe. While Napoleon's Germanic generals were distinguishing themselves on the battlefields, his bureaucracy, the same which had slaughtered so many French people, was ruthlessly suppressing the aspirations of the conquered peoples. In Belgium, for instance, André Lepoigny, an autonomous leader, was beheaded and, in proper revolutionary fashion, his head paraded on top of a spike in the center of Brussels. Although Belgium had only 3 million people, the revolutionary bureaucracy conscripted 193,000 men. 51,000 Belgians died on the battlefields. I have read thousands of letters from Belgian soldiers at the Liege archives, but I couldn't find one showing any liking for such service. France's wars were not theirs, and most were at a loss to know what they were fighting for, so far away from home. As many Belgians died in those wars as during 4 years of combat in World War I. Napoleon's bureaucracy even interfered with the church in Belgium. The archbishop was part of government intelligence, and all his bishops were French nationals. Native clergymen who objected were sent into exile or even to forced labor. The oppression by French bureaucracy must, however, not obscure Napoleon's grandiose attempt to unify Europe while there was still time. A true genius is generally recognized only a generation later. Napoleon's enemies would not let him accomplish this mission. Had he succeeded, Europe would be the world's greatest power. What was, however, contemptible in 1919 was the attempt of petty backwater politicians to cloak themselves with the imperial mantle to sell their mediocre politics. Saarland had never been French, despite being occupied from 1792 to 1814 by the revolutionary French regime. It certainly would be even less likely to become so after 4 years of war against France. It was most misleading to tell Wilson how much the people of Saarland wanted to be annexed by France. Wilson was quite confused on the issue, and his lack of historical knowledge did not help to clarify his mind. Tardieu aided and abetted Wilson's confusion with incessant demands that Saarland be returned to the fatherland. It was hard work to convince Wilson, since France had not officially claimed Saarland during the war. Tardieu, Peace, page 278. So it was now that Saarland, occupied by France for fewer than 20 of the 2,000 years of its history, had become, in Tardieu's memorandum, French land of long standing, torn away from France without consultation with its inhabitants. The will of the people of Saarland would manifest itself in 1935, after 17 years of occupation, when over 90% of them voted not to be reunited with France. The other allies could hardly believe their ears. They knew that Clemenceau and Tardieu had something else in mind besides embracing long-lost brothers. Financial interests behind the French government had their eyes on the modern coal mines, which extracted 17 million tons of coal per year, with reserves estimated at 17 billion tons. Tardieu specified his claim on the Saarland industrial complex. The working mines, the unmined coal, all the attendant industries such as steelworks, foundries, factories, etc. As for the privately owned mines, they would be bought by the German government, which would pay the mine's owners, and then would be handed over to the French government. Wilson found these claims exorbitant. I am ready to recognize that France should have the use of the mines for a limited time. He was totally opposed to their transfer to the French government. He agreed, lamented Tardieu, that we could take enough coal to compensate us our loss of production during the war, but he refused us ownership of the mines. On March 28, 1919, the difference of opinion became nasty. Wilson, so if you do not obtain what you want, you will refuse to act in concert with us. Do you want to see me go back to America? Clemenceau, no, I'm the one who is going to leave. He thereupon made a theatrical exit from the conference. Wilson's position was very complex. His health was failing, the Senate was awaiting his return to attack him. Was he to forfeit his policy over a matter of German mines? After 3 days of migraine and painful deliberation, Wilson once again relented. On March 31, he let Clemenceau have the Saarland mines and industries. No sooner had this enormous concession been extracted from Wilson than Clemenceau began to demand the whole Saarland. Tardieu came out with the same old refrain: this soil had been incorporated into France, one and indivisible, given freely and with their consent. Wilson threw up his arms: we are creating a new Alsace-Lorraine situation. France has never mentioned in any public document its intention of going back to the 1814 border. The basis for peace, accepted by the French government, referred to reparation of wrongs inflicted in 1871 and not in 1815. This basis is what links the Allies. Wilson concluded, the border of 1814 did not correspond to any economic reality. To give away such a territory without an immediate plebiscite would be inadmissible. Tardieu, Peace, page 291. Once more acrimonious deliberations followed. On April 6, the American press reported, Clemenceau demands more annexations. On the 7th, Wilson ordered the George Washington at Brest be ready to take him home. Clemenceau and Tardieu were concerned about Wilson's intended sudden departure. Wrote Tardieu, we are considering the gravity of a negative decision. Yet we have decided not to yield. Tardieu, Peace, page 300. In theory, however, they would give the appearance of yielding. Exploiting Wilson's pet policy of self-determination. Clemenceau promised to hold a plebiscite in Saarland in 15 years' time. Nevertheless, Wilson accepted the formula. Tardieu and Clemenceau were elated and sent this flattering note to Wilson: "The French government is ready to complete the proposals as suggested by President Wilson." Thus 660,000 Germans would be placed under foreign rule for 15 years, without being asked their opinion. Tardieu knew that a plebiscite after the war would have been overwhelmingly defeated. He estimated 15 years were necessary to transform the ethnic and social structure of Saarland. There was in fact no concession to Wilson, but a maneuver to gain time. Tardieu admitted, under the burden of a century of Prussian oppression, an immediate plebiscite would have been perverted. The French of Saarland would have been sacrificed forever. Tardieu counted 150,000 French people in Saarland, a totally inflated figure cooked up for Wilson's benefit. But by 1935 many Germans would have been expelled, many French bureaucrats would have been imported, electoral laws would have been amended. Saarland would now come under the control of a government commission controlled by French politicians. An international occupation force composed of Italian, British and French soldiers would keep order. During these 15 years no German politician or minister, even the Chancellor, would be allowed to set foot in Saarland. The French journalist Hervé wrote on May 31, 1919, "We are taking over the Saarland mines and in order not to be hindered in our exploitation, we are forming a small distinct state for the 600,000 Germans living in the mining area. At the end of 15 years we will try with a plebiscite to bring them to declare themselves French. We know what that means, for 15 years we are going to manipulate them and harass them, until we obtain from them this declaration. We know very well it is just an attempt to annex 600,000 Germans." Lloyd George told Wilson, "Mr. President, I believe this is an excellent plan." Wilson somewhat sardonically replied, "Why don't you apply it to Ireland?" The plan included an administrative commission presided over by a French bureaucrat and composed of a Belgian, a Dane, a Canadian, and only one German. Germany was forbidden to take part in the political life of Saarland. Saarlanders would be prohibited from serving in the German Congress, and the commission had the right to expel any public servant it felt undesirable. On April 9, Tardieu asked Wilson, in almost an ultimatum, "Will German sovereignty be suspended? Will the commission have full powers? Will the election of Saarlanders to the Reichstag be abolished?" Tardieu, Peace, page 304. Wilson agreed on all points. The next day Tardieu stated, "Our committee had drafted the 46 articles of Section 4 of the Versailles Treaty concerning Saarland. The Committee of Four would accept them on April 10. Saarland was now to pass under the control of a foreign country without the consent of its population. Within months 700 German nationalist leaders in Saarland would be put in jail. Some were sent to hard labor and one was executed." A few months later Tardieu would summarize the takeover: "On the 10th of January 1920, our engineers took control of the mines. A few days later the administrative commission would be officially installed in Saarbrücken. 15 years later, when the people of Saarland were able to vote, over 90% chose reunification with Germany, despite the fact that Germany had been forbidden to campaign. As for Tardieu's 150,000 Frenchmen, on the date of the election, January 13, 1935, they were nowhere to be seen.